Hey, good afternoon, everyone. We're assembled around the mic, and we are going to do a review for a few weeks on bad therapy, why kids aren't growing up. Abigail Schreier is our author. She's the author of best-selling author of Irreversible Damage. Now, let's make sure that everyone knows this is not a Christian author. She's not writing from a biblical worldview, and yet there's value in this book. There's much value. I've read the whole thing and working on reading through it again. And I would commend it to everyone.
Very informative.
Yeah. So what's y'all's initial impressions?
Wow.
Okay.
But I mean, I had only read through really the introduction when I got to my sermon at Gad, and I had to read a section of it because it was just that applicable. Compared to the last book we did, you know, there's a decent amount of bone for the chicken, whereas this one is a whole lot of meat. And yeah, there's bone, but it's just very different.
Yep.
A lot of statistics that she's backing her, you know, theory up, her perspective up.
Yeah, that was timely and very relevant.
Yeah, I would want every parent to read it. I mean, just like parents need to be reading this. What stood out to you, Jack, or has there anything at this point stood out to you yet?
Yeah, I've read through the first four chapters. I know we're looking to discuss chapters one and two today. But what stood out to me is, one, the medical practice of assuming from a practitioner perspective, every child has experienced something that should trigger the potential for the need for therapy. And two, this assumption that therapy is almost normative in our social society today, and that you can't grow up and be a well-adjusted adult without therapy. And it's almost like we've taken the idea that therapy should only be for those who have truly experienced something legitimately traumatic, and it should only be for a short time period with the objective to leave therapy, being whole again, or therapy is for those who have a medical condition that can't be controlled otherwise.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. Was the young lady's name Nora that she had a conversation with? Who
felt uncomfortable because she was the only one that didn't go to therapy, and she felt like she was abnormal.
Yeah, where this girl who seemed to be actually functioning in society feels like she's the odd person out because she doesn't have a diagnosis of something.
Right.
And then she, you know, the author also kind of addresses like, hey, my name is Brian and this is my diagnosis. Like, the people are wearing it as a bag of courage, and let me go ahead and set out the eggshells for you to step on as you interact with me, because this is who I am. So that level of identity with a particular diagnosis, because that was one of the things that has stuck out to me the most is, where do you walk the line? Because she addresses the idea of ADHD and social anxiety disorder, like I'll use the word made up disorders. Like, instead of calling your kids shy, they have this. Instead of saying they're a picky eater, they have, you know, this food avoidance or whatever. But one of the words she used was syndrome-y, in this essence of someone is kind of on the autism spectrum. And kind of walking that with what does that... That was the one that kind of seemed like it might be crossing a threshold back and forth between a legitimate medical diagnosis and you just need to, you know, buckle up, buttercup.
So how do we navigate through, as pastors, how do we navigate through understanding, being empathetic, being compassionate towards someone who believes they have something like this? I want to be cautious here because somebody listening to this podcast is going to really believe that, one, they have something, and two, that their therapist is helping them. If we don't acknowledge a little bit of that, then how do we keep them from turning it off and maybe getting a little bit of the meat that they need to eat off the bone?
I think Jack's point that she makes, are you approaching the physical therapy, or the therapy, sorry. But if you're approaching therapy from the standpoint of, this is short term, it's going to end.
Instead, and what goes against that is the therapist all make it a long term. Yeah. You know, you have to come every week or every 2 weeks, and
yeah, I mean,
you know, they don't want to let you go because that's money in their pocket, and so they're going to constantly, well, you're not ready yet, and she addresses that as well. So it takes, like she said, you know, she went to therapy, was trying to have a friend to talk to, but then she reached a point as a mature adult, she was like, you know what, I need a break. You know, when her therapist told her, you're not ready to be married, and, you know, that's not what you should do. And she's like, okay, well, I disagree, so I'm going to take a break. And I found it interesting, after several months, she did go back, you know, and re-engaged her therapist and saw her for another period of time,
and then broke away again.
So it's, yes, you know, if you have the maturity to engage when you feel you need it, and then disengage when you feel that you need to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she made it clear, you know, her therapist wasn't real thrilled with her when she said, you know, I need a break. It was like, no, you don't. You need to come back.
Well, it's also the fact that she made the point, I'm the adult making the decision.
Right, yeah.
I'm not a young teenager who's impressionable and can't be mature enough to decide. Your approach has become intrusive, and I'm finding myself believing against what I actually believe. So therefore, I need to take the break.
Yeah.
It's no longer of a therapeutic nature. It has now become a influencing nature. A lot of, and y'all, you made the mention about the question, you know, when is it helpful and why do they feel it's helpful? Even just talk, you know how it is. If you just vent to your significant other sometimes, and if they're of the type that can handle it, sometimes that feels
therapeutic.
Therapeutic. Or if you have a friend, it feels therapeutic. You can just go unload and then you're done. You know, that kind of thing.
You don't need the whys and hows and
right
how to get through.
It's not about the nail.
Right. It's just
the video once said, you know.
Yeah, I just need
that continually circling it.
Right. And everything else. But sometimes therapy is about circling it so that you never actually release it.
Right, which I think she brought up as a danger, you know, that often, you know, dwelling on all your childhood problems isn't helpful, you know, because it's not helping you get past them. It's making you relive them over and over and over and over again, which becomes unhealthy.
And here's where therapy would be helpful if it centers you to if it helps you quit skirting the problem and actually address the central issue.
Yeah, but I think about, you know, you accidentally said physical therapist because of your shoulder. I remember when I was, my last time I went to therapy was with my hands. And, you know, and so we're going to have 12 weeks of therapy, and every time my copay was $25 or something. And at the time, $25 was like $25. And, you know, eventually Mike, I just decided there's nothing more you're doing for me at this therapy session that I can't just do on my own. So, you know, we're done. And you know, I've got as much back on my hand than I'm ever going to get. You know, that's... But these therapy sessions, they don't have an end state.
No.
That's the difference between the psychotherapy and the physical therapy. Mike, once you got to where your arm was at the same point as your other arm and you had these milestones that you reached, then we're done, right? And you're not... 2 years later, you're not still coming.
Well, part of that's the insurance, because we're only going to do 12 weeks. And then
right, but their insurance doesn't do it on the psychotherapy.
No, I know.
Which is very, and it's a contributor to the high cost of everything, yeah. because yeah. I never solve your problems. You know, the goal isn't four sessions and you now can return to society as a normal person, because, you know, that's cutting off your hand to spite your face from a therapist's yeah. perspective.
Right.
And we're not, we as a society are not addressing that.
I think it's the division between the seen and the unseen. We can physically see Mike without a science degree, without advanced education in a therapist world, he can tell and he can attest to this. My right shoulder is now equal to my left shoulder. He's got measurable, quantifiable proof. But true. When we're talking something that is mental, and what this author will not address because she can't as an unbeliever, is the spiritual aspect that also comes along with this. Because one of the things that she kind of had pointed out is the things that we're thinking about. I'm trying to turn back to the page that I had it on. Because as she's listing off all these different things, everything that came to my mind was, it's on page 9, the paragraph she says, individual therapy can intensify bad feelings, too. Psychiatrist Samantha Boardman wrote candidly about a patient who quit therapy after a few weeks. All we do is talk about the bad stuff in my life.
Right.
Okay. And then immediately I'm like, Philippians 4, okay, whatsoever things are pure, honest, you know, a good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. And it's like that concept alone of Paul would say your therapy concept is flawed because you're dwelling on the bad. And he would say, believer, you need to be dwelling on the good.
What God has done for you.
Right.
Right. The blessings that you experience, the salvation that is in Christ and Christ alone, the victory that was secured for you. But yeah. that's not to the therapist's advantage.
No. But that's what I'm saying is why it's unseen, is you can't see that your mental state is better.
Yeah.
The therapist so can't I can say individual this could. Needs to be longer. We need 8 more sessions. We need whatever it is. And insurance is just going to go along with it.
Right. And then I, as the patient, capitulate to you, the subject matter expert.
Right.
And I make the assumption that you know best. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is happening. I mean, the focus of the book is on children.
Right.
You know, it's not adults, it's children. And it's on the idea that the parents have handed over parenting to the subject matter expert. You, Jack, no longer know what's best for your 2 daughters. The psychologist, the therapist, the mental doctor, they know.
In the school system.
In the school system, the counselor, the doctors, just everybody. Yeah. They all know better than you.
Yeah, and I would say, too, that a part of this is that, and we talked about it, Pastor, right after I got through with the first, I devoured the first 4 chapters right away. And I can't remember if this is actually, so forgive me if it gets into chapter 3 or chapter 4, but the concept of we don't have weekends anymore. These kids don't have weekends. Like we talked about it, when we faced bullish tactics or any type of bullying aspects, and we dealt with it at school, we dealt with it however we dealt with it, there came a point in which I went home. And there was no cell phone. There was no
social media.
Mm-hmm. There was no texting available, anything else. So my mind and my got somewhat of a break from it. I got to escape to my family. I got to escape to my closest friends that were probably my neighbors in the around the street. And if they did call my house, they met the father who answered the phone. And it was one of these, don't you call my house no more, but, you know, and the bell rings throughout the whole house. Then, you know, dad's had enough. They're not going to be calling back. It might even have some color adjectives if you didn't grow up in the right kind of home. And you had that break. They keep it secret and they don't have that anymore. So now parents are at their wits' ends. And so instead of being parents and investigating, they're going to these doctors and saying, find out for me.
Yeah.
So I think there's a double edge to the parenting aspect to it. Not only do you need as a parent to take back your ownership from this aspect, you need to step up in your parenting and find out. And then be, you got permission from God to take all the protective measures you need to protect, do, which includes taking away the phone if you need to create boundaries that protect.
Darius, you're the youngest one in the room, I think, or is Brian?
Yeah, no.
And so when the phone rang at your house, Darius, assuming it was a landline, right?
Mm-hmm. It was.
Was it a rude interruption?
Depending on the day. The caveat to my childhood is I was a child of a single parent, so right. She was often at work. Gone. So I was usually the man of the house when mom wasn't there, so I actually had to answer.
All right, how about you, Mike? Was like...
It was very rare when the phone rang.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when it did, it was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I'd say the phone didn't ring all that much. I knew when Beth and I got married, we had a landline. We got more phone calls, but that was the beginning era. Like even in the late 80s, early 90s, you're starting to get the
telemarketers.
And yeah, I remember having to call the 1-800 and get put on the do not call list and back and forth. And then you get the crank calls at 3 o'clock in the morning and.
Yeah, sorry, I just remember it being an interruption. Like, we would not stop having dinner to answer the phone. That could wait. Whatever it was wasn't that important. What we were doing was more important. Mike?
We stopped. Somebody answered the phone.
I was going to say,
did you have an answering machine?
As a kid growing up?
Okay, so we did not. Okay. Like, I distinctly remember, we didn't have an answering machine for a very long time, and we also didn't have cordless phones. Which, as a teenager who was social, who wanted to talk to, either my friends or my girlfriend on the phone, I wanted a cordless phone.
Did you have one of those 100-foot coils, though?
No.
Yeah, when you have a dad that works for AT&T and Bell Telephone, there were certain telephones that had, the 50-foot literal cord. And so, in the basement, I could walk almost the whole basement and still be on the phone.
Yeah, my uncle worked for General Telephone and Electric, so we got those couple cords.
Yeah, but your point is so well taken, Jack.
But we
kids never get a break.
Yeah, and
they never get a break.
But I thought after that conversation with you, I thought further back, and she says it started ramping up after World War II. Well, that's when TV was introduced. So for the first time, somebody on the East Coast could envy somebody on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And we could envy each other in different regions of the world, and it wasn't just our little neighborhoods. And then as that grew and cable came over and we quit having the TV shut off, it's 11 p.m., mm-hmm. you get the dial, fuzz. 6 a.m., you get the dial, the national anthem, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden the Lone Ranger's on. I remember that distinctly from my childhood.
That's a little more for my
childhood. And, you got that going on. I'd get up in the morning and just, here comes the Lone Ranger. First TV show I watch every morning. And just distinct. And we had that. And then it became 24/7 TV. Mm-hmm. And now we're not shut off from that exposure to the world. And then eventually, we were adults, but it became the internet. And then it became the internet in our hand. Mm-hmm. And then it became constant communication in our hand.
It was dial-up internet.
And no wonder they're riddled with fear. No wonder they're riddled with, and what the parents aren't doing, even though they're hovering all the time, is actually engaging.
Yeah. Tell the difference.
Hovering
and engaging.
Well, hovering is they're always around, and they'll go to the school and say, "What are you doing about it?" Or to the doctor, "What can you guys do about it? What can you?" And they're hovering around because something's wrong, and I'm around enough to know something's wrong. But I'm not sitting down and saying, "Hey, John, what's bothering you?" Mm-hmm. Sally, come sit down and talk to me. Let's turn this phone off. We're going to sit down right over here, and you're going to sit down and you're going to talk to me.
Yeah, which is what two of the statements from page 23 that our author brings up is that any parent can take away the phone, but only the psychologist can diagnose the child and send them for medication because it's easier to put the blame on the therapist and the medication than it is to take the responsibility to take away the phone, because she says later on the same page that that's how they make, you can't take that away because that's how they make plans with their friends
and I don't want them to be the one who's missing out on that.
Yeah, well, the other point she brought up is that school, a lot of school systems won't take the kids
because it keeps them calm.
Right, because then they get all jittery and they can't pay attention in class because that's their security blanket.
Not to mention, we don't want to pay for a broken phone, we don't want to pay for a stolen phone, and we don't want to be sued by parents. Mm-hmm.
Your dad's, I know, Darius, you said your exception. I felt like my dad had the answer. And he was very confident he had the answer, that he knew what was best for me at any given time. He didn't need a therapist to tell him what was best. He didn't even need his pastor to tell him what was best. He knew what was best for his firstborn son at any given time.
My dad did too, and he taught me well that I think the same thing.
But our parents don't have that level of confidence, Mike. They don't have the level of confidence that my kid doesn't need a therapist. My kid doesn't need a diagnosis. My kid, we can work through this. I mean, that's what she's addressing in this book, is this lack of confidence. And so what would we say to the believer? Well, we would say that God has given you the Holy Spirit. Let's start with that. We would say that you've been given the revealed word of God. Is it not competent enough to give you what you need to, I mean, where are you at on this, Darius? I assume you feel like you know what's best for your two boys.
Absolutely, yeah. And kind of to your point, I would say, as a believer, we need to recognize the tools, the God-given tools that we have at our disposal. We're not to leave everything to the so-called experts. Are we going to mess it up? Yes, and I think that's something that we need to acknowledge, that as parents, nobody's going to have a perfect track record as a parent. A sinful being is going to mess it up a lot. But God, we have a gracious Savior who is faithful. We have the power of prayer at our disposal. So as we're seeking to raise our children in an effective, God-honoring manner, to leave it to the experts is to essentially leave it in the hands of whomever. God has given us that domain of authority. So instead of being like Adam and giving that responsibility to Eve and seeing things go further and further downhill, we ought to take responsibility, seek help, use the tools as a coach, but not as a crutch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I had to add in also, I mean, if there is, like as Jack said, I mean, when there is a need for therapy, seeking out a Christian counselor, that at least has a, or should have a Bible-based approach to things.
A nouthetics Christian counselor.
Right.
That bases the time on scripture.
Right.
Not a secular counselor who is a Christian, so they dabble a little God over it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because it bothers me when I talk to church members or Christians, and they're like, I have to take my child to therapy. Oh, where do you go? And then that some secular therapist was like how? It's like,
what are you hoping to accomplish?
That's not a really great choice.
It's a lot of times an insurance issue. A lot of the Christian counselors are unsupported or don't take the insurances, or the insurances don't pay out to them because they don't go against the convention of the medical statements that they have to make. Here's another issue.
But then it comes down to, do you want what's best for your child? Not eat out that week, do what's right for my child.
And a lot of it is they see ticks in their children, and they don't take the time to figure out why the tick is there. Again, parent engagement. There's a certain number of ticks that have to be present for a child to have a medical diagnosis. And what they'll see is they'll see one, two, or three, and they'll become convinced, and then they'll convince the child. And then the child, or they'll convince the therapist, and then they'll go into it with that, wade into it with that mindset. And that before you know it, the child will become so convinced that they'll adapt the others. I've seen children do that. Versus the children that you know from the very beginning that there's something imbalanced in them. God made them special that way. And they're going to need medicine. They're going to need legitimate therapy. And with it, if they're doing it right, the parents engaged in it the whole time, there's going to come a time when they may possibly be able to come off all of it. And that's the objective. Or to be on as minimal as possible. So that everything's reframed for them to live healthy, right. Adjusted, with as minimal help as possible. And but most times it goes the opposite direction.
Yeah, because it's such a tough call, because I think back, you know, like my first couple years on staff here, and I distinctly remember one of the teachers in our academy recommending to a parent to have their child tested, to maybe put them on a super low dose of something to get the child to calm down as a sixth grade boy just a little. And there's been no shortage of boys that I've watched go on medicine, and all of a sudden the spark of life just gets sucked out of them because they're being drugged. And then so you see the one side of it, and then there's the other side, and it's a very different type of therapy. But a road we've had to walk is my son's in behavioral therapy, which was simply for the essence of he's not picking up on social cues that he needs to be picking up on. And I can't be with him every day, all day long, to walk through these things with him. So what do I do to get him there? Whereas my son is with a behavioral therapist a couple hours a week, but there is no medication involved. And there are set objectives, and there are ultimately limits that either we set or insurance has set, that this is what we're trying to get. And when we get there, this is when we're done.
And that's the difference between the emotional therapy and a targeted therapy. And that's what the parents, I think Christian parents, if they're going to have their children in therapy, that has to be the difference. Even if it's for an emotional trauma, there has to be a target to it.
Mm-hmm. But when you say emotional trauma, the norm has been so much now, Jack, that means I must put my child in therapy. And if I don't put my child in therapy, then the assumption is that they're going to be behind the eight ball right. for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and this
but the point she makes, if I can just finish, is yep. kids figure it out.
Yeah, most of them do.
They work through it.
Everything you call trauma is truly trauma.
They can work through
right.
They can work through a lot of stuff. And that sometimes she argues, and not from a philosophical perspective, but from a statistical data perspective, that they overcome it, that they don't need weeks of onslaught of more and more therapy. I thought that was so helpful. You know, let's give them a chance to heal themselves. How good did our God make our brain that we can compartmentalize, that we can put stuff in a box and move forward and continue living?
You learn to cope.
Yes.
That's a critical skill that kids are no longer having developed.
That's correct. Well. Yeah.
So, I mean, we're...
Because we step in as ambassadors for them. Mm-hmm. Every opportunity we get, I'll get the bully to stop bullying you.
Right.
It probably, except for Brian, I don't know, Jack... I know I got bullied because I was a small kid.
I was the fat kid. I might have been, you know, I'm huge. I mean, I've been 6'4 since I was 13, but I was also fat. So,
I mean I'm not. Parents, we want you to think through things before you make decisions. This is a great book. You ought to buy it on Audible, or you ought to buy hard copy or paper copy. Again, the book is Bad Therapy, Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up, Abigail Schreier. And we got it on Amazon, right, Mike? That's yes. where we found it.
Yep.
She reads the Audible for herself. She's a good reader. I enjoyed listening as well. We're going to get into chapter 3 next week. We'll read you some paragraphs next week. We'll give you some more specifics on what she says and what we think you need to hear from this book. Thanks for listening.